We are wrestling with Corinthians 7, which I would argue is up there on the list of difficult New Testament chapters. Last week, we talked about how it appears the topic is the Corinthians wrote to Paul, and one of the things they mentioned was this idea that seems to have been circulating in Corinth that it was good for someone not to be married, meaning a believer not to be married. And that kind of puts Paul in a tizzy, and you can kind of feel it throughout the chapter, because there we're going to see there's a sense in which he agrees that there are spiritual advantages associated with being single. But he doesn't agree with everything that the Corinthians are saying, and he thinks they've gotten off track. And so first, the thing he makes clear to them is that to the extent people in Corinth were taking that concept and saying it meant someone who was already married to another believer should leave their spouse to focus on God, that's off base. Don't do that. Then he kind of gives widows and widowers two options. He says, it's perfectly righteous for you to get married again if you want, but don't forget, it's also good to be single, and there are good reasons to do that. Then he talks about mixed marriages and how if you're married to an unbeliever when you convert, and the unbeliever is willing to stay married with you, stick with that. That's good. But then he says, if the unbeliever's like, well, I didn't sign up to be married to a Christian, so I want to leave, let him go. Don't fight with that. I believe he says that the believer is not bound by the marriage in that situation. That's somewhat controversial. And that's where we pick up in the middle of the chapter, but all of that is kind of connected. And I think he's trying in this section we're about to get to a general principle that's underlying the advice he's giving throughout the chapter. So picking up in verse 17, nevertheless, each one should retain or abide in the place in life that the Lord assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches or assemblies. And so kind of abiding as you are is sort of a principle beneath everything Paul is giving. And it would be really easy with no context to think, well, Paul is saying, were you a college student when you converted? You need to be a college student the rest of your life. Were you living in Idaho when you converted? You better stay in Idaho the rest of your life. And thankfully, Paul gives us some examples that show that's not what he means. I think what he means is don't worry about changing worldly status. Don't think there's some magical worldly status that is going to make your life better. And I think part of the reason he's giving this advice is that that is what our culture is constantly telling us. If you could just get married, everything would be better. If you could just have kids, everything would be better. If you could just have this promotion and make more money, everything would be better. If you would just buy this brand of shirt, everything would be better, right? We're constantly getting these messages that we need to change our status and that will make everything better. And the message Paul is going to make is to give them is no, that is not at all true. You can thrive spiritually wherever you are, wherever Christ finds you. And so your priority needs to be on Christ, not worldly status. Okay? And so look at the examples he gives, starting in 18. Was a man already circumcised when he was called. He should not become uncircumcised or try to hide the signs of circumcision, you could translate, which evidently was actually a thing in the first century, which is kind of scary to me as a guy. I don't even want to think about that. But the commentators say it was real. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called, he should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. And so it's worth taking a moment to reflect on how radical Paul's comment would have been to young Paul. Like, I bet when Paul was 18, he would never have predicted he would write that paragraph. And think back, when Paul is living, there is a temple in Jerusalem. When he writes this, there's still a temple in Jerusalem. And if you are a Gentile from Alabama like me, you can only go so far into that temple, and then you got to stop. And your buddy who's Jewish gets to keep going. And so there is a message being sent to you that if you want to be close to God, you've got to change your status. You've got to become Jewish before you can get closer to God. And the message Paul, to his own surprise, finds himself devoting his life to is that through Christ, it no longer matters whether you're Jew or Gentile. Through Christ, either one of you can get as close to God as the other. And so literally, that status means nothing now. What matters is your relationship to Christ and you trying to obey Christ. And some of you may be thinking already, well, then what about Timothy? So let's flip over to Acts. I think we're headed to Acts 16. So looking at 1, he, meaning Paul, came to Derbe and then to Lystra, where a disciple named Timothy lived, whose mother was a Jewish and a believer, but whose father was a Greek. The brothers, meaning believers, at Lystra and Iconium spoke well of him. Paul wanted to take him along on the journey, so Paul wanted to make him part of his missionary team. So he circumcised him because of the Jews who lived in that area, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. So this is one of the ways we know Paul isn't saying this remain as you are is a ironclad law, and that what you were when you became a Christian is how God wants you to stay the rest of your life. There may be good reasons to change a worldly status. And in Paul's mind, one of the good reasons is if you think you can advance the cause of Christ somehow. Paul is going to say, in one of his other epistles, I tried to become all things to all men that somehow I might save some of them, right? And so Paul is for status changes that can help you reach out to someone else. And so the way we might think of it this way is, let's suppose that there is some group in Sioux Falls that if I'm wearing my Alabama Crimson Tide jersey, they would be horribly offended by that. Paul would say, when you go out to do ministry to that group and try to talk to them, by all means, take off your Alabama jersey. Don't say Roll Tide. Right? But when you walk into sanctuary, if you're an Alabama fan or a Vikings fan or whatever, you're equally close to God, you should be equally welcome in the church, because one is not better than the other. In Paul's words, that's nothing, immaterial, right? So I think that's kind of the reconciliation for why he can say in one breath, the status means nothing, but in the other breath say, Timothy, I think it'd be a good idea if you did this so that you could be a more effective minister. Questions, comments, concerns? All right, let's keep going and look at the next one. Sorry, did you have a question? Was there a question?
How would they know?
Yeah, that's a great question. How would they know? So, you know, and I think part of what is going on in Timothy is that there would be an assumption. And, you know, as a lawyer, I don't like assumptions, but we all make them. And so, oh, that Timothy, his dad's a Greek, he must be uncircumcised. So this would give Timothy the ability to say, no, I am, and I'm not doing anything wrong by coming to your synagogue and talking to you. But one other thing to keep in mind is one of the Romans' favorite activities is hot baths, and they don't have them in their house. So public bathing in the nude is a thing in the Roman Empire. So people may find out. I don't know. Yeah. Good times. All right. Let's look at the next example. So then pick it up at 7:20. Each one should remain in the situation which he was in when God called him. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you, although if you can gain your freedom, do so. So again, Paul would have been writing to a good chunk of people who are slaves, bondservants, whichever term you want to use in the Roman Empire. That basically means they were in the position where they had to go to someone with more financial means and say, in exchange for you giving me shelter and food, I will live in your household, I will do what you want, I will be subject to your authority. And that was the trade a lot of people in the Roman Empire had to make for all kinds of reasons, including that they lived in an area that had been conquered by the Romans. So Paul tells them, don't be bothered by that. Even though you're at the bottom of the social totem pole in the Roman Empire, don't feel you are a lesser human being or less spiritual because you're not on that. You're not as high as some of the other people on the congregation in the social status, but if you can get your freedom, take advantage of it. And then he gives both freed people and slaves in the congregation a way to think about their status. For he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freedman. I think what Paul means is that you may be a slave in the Roman Empire, but through Christ, you've been freed from the kingdom of Satan and the realm of the world in a spiritual sense. So regardless of what your human status was in the eyes of other human beings, spiritually, all of us were a slave at one time. Paul says in Romans, you were slaves to sin. Through Christ, you've been freed. And in Paul's mind, that is a greater freedom than anything any mere Roman can do for you. Okay? Conversely, he who was a free man when he was called is Christ's slave. So Paul also says in Romans, once you're a Christian, you have an obligation, not to the sin nature anymore, but to Christ, to obey him. So even those who are high in the Roman totem pole, who've become believers, are in a spiritual sense slaves to Christ. And so everybody in the congregation is both a slave and a freed person in a sense. And so, yes, when you walk out those doors into Roman society, other Romans are going to look at you different based on whether you're a freedman or a slave. But in reality, Paul says, both of you are some of both in some ways. And so there shouldn't be any distinction in the church. You should not think one status is better than the other. He's not pro-slavery. He says in verse 23, you were bought at a price, meaning by Christ. Do not become slaves of men. And I can't prove this, but I think there's a double entendre there. He's certainly not in favor of anyone becoming a slave. If you can avoid that, do that. But I think there are two ways we can become slaves. In the Roman Empire, you can literally become a bondservant. But to the extent what other humans think is determining your behavior, you are a slave to their opinion. And so, to some extent, all of us are slaves to peer pressure. I don't think there's anybody in this room that is completely immune to what other human beings think, right? And so, Paul is encouraging them, don't let what the Roman Empire is telling you is important to do with your life determine that. If you do, you're making yourself a slave to the Roman Empire. Instead, your focus should be Christ and what his priorities are for your life. Be a slave to him, not to men, whether you're a freed person or a slave. But if you get the opportunity to improve your lot in this world, why not take advantage of it? So not an ironclad law, but I think he's emphasizing it because everything the Corinthians would have been told until they, most of them fairly recently, became believers, would have been the Roman way of life is what matters. And so he's pushing back against that cultural current. All right, questions, comments, concerns? All right, so now he's going to apply that principle to young people, which is a category hasn't really talked about it. So first to 24, brothers, each man is responsible to God, should remain in the situation God called him to. All right, then he says in the NIV, now about virgins, and the word translated there is most technically and literally translated as virgin, but the commentators say that's not the only way it gets used back then. So it could mean just a young adult who's not married yet. It could even mean someone who's engaged, and it is going to be clear as we work through the chapter that he's thinking about people who seem to be engaged, and so some of your translations may have something like betrothed there. Okay? Not entirely sure what he means here because of what he's going to do in verse 29, but let's work with this. I think it's clear he's now talking to young single people. And he says, I have no command from the Lord. What he means there is that this isn't something Jesus talked about. But I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I would say that is more cautious than Paul typically expresses himself. And you can, I think it foreshadows, he's going to lay out multiple options that he believes are righteous and ultimately put the ball in the audience's camp to decide what to do with it. But it doesn't mean this section is less inspired than anything else Paul wrote. He says, because of the present or impending crisis or distress. We'll come back to that. So there's something that Paul thinks is significant and problematic. He says, I think it is good for you to remain as you are. Are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Do not look for a wife. So here we see the remain as you are principle applied to young people. And he seems to be saying, if you are unattached, don't invest all your energy in seeking to change that status. It's good to remain as you are. If you're already married and you've already acquired the obligations of marriage, don't seek to change that status. You need to live out that status in faith to Christ. I think he's going to say some things later that help flesh that out, so let's keep going. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, probably meaning a young... So this section is kind of primarily written like it's talking to young males, but he throws in references to females too. So he says, if a young female marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. So the two things he's mentioned as why you might not want to follow the Roman cultural current, and let me back up and say, if you were a Roman, remember the worldview is that the vast majority of Romans are really not sure there's much of an afterlife. If there is one, they don't know what it is. So the Roman life program is absolutely focused on what you need to do with your life is improve your worldly social standing. And one of the ways you do that is you marry well. And then you get busy having kids because who knows what's going to happen to you when you die and your kids are your legacy and their goal is to have a minimum of three because the death rate for kids in the Roman Empire is staggering. And actually, they'd like to have many of those. And if you get divorced, you remarry as soon as you can. If you're a widow or a widower, you remarry as soon as you can. That is your goal in life, right? And so Paul is talking to people who absolutely would be feeling social pressure to get married. And he's saying, wait a minute, there are other things to think about here. One of them is there's this impending crisis or present crisis. Another is those who marry actually face many troubles in life. You're acquiring additional responsibilities that can be painful. I think those two ideas are connected, but let's keep going because we're going to get some more clues as to, I think, where Paul's coming from. What I mean, brothers, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they had none. Those who mourn as if they did not. Those who are happy or rejoice as if they were not, meaning weren't that happy. Those who buy something as if it were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them, for this world in its present form is passing away. So going back to the time is short, I think there is a sense in which Paul means the time is literally short in the sense that Christ could come back at any time. And we know that when he does, he's going to put an end to this whole world order that the Romans are so invested in. And Paul lives as though that could literally happen at any time. I think there's also a sense in which Paul doesn't know when that's going to happen. He realizes he doesn't know when it's going to happen. And so what he also means is that this is the next thing that could happen. And if you think about what life was like, if you're a believer before Jesus and John the Baptist show up on the scene, you're kind of living in this age that's been going on for centuries and centuries where you do these Jewish festivals. And yes, there are these passages in Scripture about the Messiah, but you have no idea who the Messiah is. You have no idea how long life is going to go on just like it's been. Then Jesus shows up on the scene, says, I am the Messiah. The old age has ended. A new age is here. Then he gets crucified, rises from the dead. If you're someone like Paul, you've actually met resurrected Jesus. You've seen him. So now you know in a way that it was impossible to know before Jesus shows up what is next. Paul knows in a firsthand way that we can't know. He's seen a glimpse of how the old order is going away and what's next. And I think that's part of why he is able to live his life recognizing that's more real than the Roman Empire that he sees all around them. And so Paul knows that if you are obsessed with all the things the Romans are obsessed with, you are investing in a company that is a dead man walking. Its bankruptcy is assured. It is going to burn. So don't invest all your energy in these worldly status changes that are ultimately nothing. On the final day, it's really not going to matter whether you were single or married. What's going to matter is whether you were single or whether you were married, were you faithful to Christ in the situation you ended up in? That's what your priority needs to be on. And so, as we walk through life, yes, we're going to be affected. There are going to be circumstances that make you happy, but if they're worldly circumstances, don't get too high. If there are things that make you sad, don't get too low. It's all passing away, and a new reality is coming. Don't lose sight of that new reality. All right? And Paul argues there is a sense in which being married and acquiring a family actually makes that harder to do than being single. So look at 32. I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs. How can he please the Lord? There's a big assumption in that. There are plenty of single guys in America that have zero concern for that, right? So the assumption is this is a believer who wants to please Christ. There are certain ways in which not being married, and the Romans would assume that would mean you'd have kids, and not having kids makes it easier, removes some obstacles to being focused on the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. And I think there are a lot of women here would say, not all married men. Right? And not, I mean, even good married men, not all the time. I'll admit that, right? His interests are divided, but the assumption here is a believing married man who wants to please his wife, you know, tries to do that most of the time. We're all flawed, right? Your interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Again, not necessarily, but go with it. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I am saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. And I would argue part of what is going on is something that I think is becoming more of an issue in our society. We aren't anywhere close to the Romans. Is that Paul knows better, probably more firsthand than most of us in the room, that Christianity is not that welcome in the Roman Empire. The Jews don't like it. The Romans are tolerating it for the moment, but he's been beaten, he's been stoned, he's been thrown in jail. All of that is easier, I think, to endure if you're single. And I think Paul knows being married is a pressure point for the Roman Empire. It's one thing to endure persecution for yourself. It's another thing to put your spouse and your kids at risk. So I think there is a vulnerability that Paul sees based on what he can see coming in the Roman Empire to being married that if you're Roman, you would never even consider. That's not part of the cost for a Roman as they consider being married. But there are other distractions. I mean, it's easy as a married person to justify in your mind, based on your own desires, but it's easy to tell yourself, I need more money because I need to provide for my family. Maybe if you don't really need as much money as you think, right? So anyway, Paul is saying there is an advantage to being single, which is that your interests cannot be divided. Now, I don't think this means, and I think Paul is clear to say that, you aren't sinning if you choose to get married and you take on those obligations. You just need to understand priority. And I think it's helpful to compare two other passages kind of on the same line of thought that at first glance seem totally opposed. So flip over to Luke. This is one of the more troubling things Jesus says. We're going to look at Luke 9. So 59. Jesus said to another man, "Follow me." But the man replied, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." And we think what the guy is saying there is not saying, literally, I've got a funeral I need to go to. He's saying, let me go home, wait for my father to die, take care of that business, then follow you. Okay? Jesus said to him, let the dead bury their own dead, but you go and proclaim the kingdom of God. Still another said, I will follow you, Lord, but first let me go back and say goodbye to my family. Jesus replied, no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the service in the kingdom of God. So very troubling, kind of makes you do a double take. Now flip over to 1 Timothy. Five. We're going to pick up at 3. Give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. And this is the first verse I want to emphasize. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn, first of all, to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family and so repaying their parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. And then on down in verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So how do we reconcile what Jesus says in Luke, what Paul says pleases God? I think the answer is, don't think you can put family obligations before Christ. Like, you can't say, I will be concerned about spiritual matters after I'm married. I just need to find a wife and get married and settle down, and then I'll have time for this religious thing. I just need to get this promotion, and then I can focus on Christ. I just need to get through law school, and then I can focus on Christ. You've missed the boat, right? That's what Luke is aimed at saying, don't think that way. But what Paul is saying in 1 Timothy is wherever you are, and if you have relatives, you do have obligations. And one of the ways you show your faith in Christ is by taking care of the people around you. So Paul is absolutely for married people taking care of their kids and their parents, right? That's not what he's saying in 1 Corinthians. But he is saying, Before you acquire those obligations, take your time and think about the cost and whether you really want to do it. Okay? All right, let's keep going. 36. So, actually, I need to slow down. So, when we get into 36 through 38, this is like a totally swamp in terms of the commentaries, and there's two main views out there. And I want to slow down here because there is a traditional view that was popular with Augustine, with Calvin, with Luther, with multiple church fathers before Augustine. And I got persuaded it's wrong, and that the modern take, and by modern, it's been around probably the last century, 100 years, they've actually figured some things out that change the spin on it. You may not even realize that debate is out there depending on what translation you're looking at, because the NIV and ESV both kind of take the modern spin on it. So the traditional view was that Paul is switching gears now and is talking to a father who's considering whether to give away his daughter in marriage. The reason they thought that was how they understood verse 38, which in the NIV reads, "So then he who marries the virgin does right, but he who does not marry her does even better." Which, if you're reading that in the NIV, you think, why in the world would you think that's about a father and daughter? It's because they thought the only way to translate the verbs in that verse was, he who gives the virgin in marriage does right. He who does not give her in marriage does even better. And they thought, based on the verb form, that was like the clearest verse in the passage. And one tried and true principle of Bible interpretation is when you have a cryptic passage, focus on what you can make sense of and kind of interpret the rest of it. And so they kind of worked back, even though the earlier verses create massive problems for this view. And so if you're trying to work with this, it would read, if anyone thinks he's acting improperly towards the virgin, he's considering giving away in marriage. And as the NIV still has it, if she's getting along in years, meaning if she's getting to the point where the Roman Empire is no longer socially acceptable for her to get married, and so you're worried about her aging out of the ability to get married, he should do as he wants, he's not sinning, they should get married. And this is the big fly in the ointment for the traditional view that was always there and is still there, and the modern commentators argue is actually the clear kind of signpost. Is he's talking to two people who are considering getting married, and the father would not be considering getting married to the daughter. And so this was always a big problem for the traditional view. But then I would argue another big problem is verse 37. Paul says, "But the man who settled the matter in his own mind," so that's qualification number one, "who's under no compulsion but has control over his own will," meaning desires, big qualification number two, "and who has made up his mind not to marry, this man also does the right thing." So I'll be honest with you, and this is definitely a guy's perspective, this sounds way more to me like a guy who's trying to decide whether he can live a celibate lifestyle like Paul than a dad who's trying to decide whether he's given his daughter away in marriage. I'm sorry, Emily, but that's not that deep, okay? All these qualifications sound way more like they're aimed at a young male, and it's like, you better be sure about this in your own mind before you go this route. You better be comfortable. You are at peace with this decision if you want to go this route. So I think that's a big problem for it. So I think the traditional view is actually wrong, and that this is the way the NIV has it is mostly right. And so what Paul is saying, if anyone thinks he's acting improperly towards the young woman or fiance he's engaged to. I actually think the NIV is wrong when it says if she's getting along in years. It's actually a reference to, and if you are having trouble controlling your own desires. Part of the reason you end up with such two different possibilities is the commentators say the word Paul uses is, this is the only place in the New Testament it gets used. It's even a rare word in Greek. And so it's basically hyper attached to another word. So that's why there's this debate about it. I felt like the modern view is correct, that it's actually saying, and if you're having trouble controlling your desires and you feel you ought to get married, you should do what you want. And this is really important. Paul is really saying this is one of those times, and it's kind of rare in Scripture, where you really do get to do what you want. Both life choices are good in Paul's mind. Okay? But then Paul says, if you have peace about not getting married, so if you've settled the matter in your own mind, if you're under no compulsion but you have control over your sexual desires, and you've made up your mind not to get married, you also do the right thing. And then he says, and the one who doesn't get married does even better. So he who marries the virgin does right, but he who does not marry her does even better. So there is a sense in Paul's mind in which there are advantages to being single and being able to focus completely on ministry and Christ. And then he kind of, that's all kind of written more from the male perspective. Then he sort of flips around to the female perspective, although he goes back to someone who's married. A woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. There are all kinds of qualifications to that that he's talked about earlier in the chapter. He's assuming you still remember that. And what he wants to focus on is if her husband dies, she's free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. So his advice is that if you do have the opportunity to decide to get married, recommends marrying a believer. In my judgment, she's happier if she stays as she is. So same sort of choice. Someone in this position, free to marry, not marry, but think about before you do get married, there are advantages to staying single. But ultimately, you get to weigh that. And I think what Paul will want you to understand is that if you choose to go the marriage route, you then have to be willing to make being married part of your faith walk, even if you face certain pressures and painful experiences that you wouldn't have if you'd stayed single. But if that's where you feel Christ is living, leading you, that's great. On the other hand, if you feel like Christ has called you to a single life and you're at peace with that, go with that. Either way, don't sit there and think that if you add the other status, everything would be great, and get hung up on status changes rather than being obedient to Christ. All right, questions, comments, concerns about all that? It's a really difficult passage.
So what would Paul say about system change?
So like trying to change the Roman Empire for the better? So I think it would be difficult for Paul to answer, in part because it wasn't an option. So I don't know how much he thought about that. Like, the Roman emperor is going to do what the Roman emperor wants to do. And so about the only thing I think Paul says is pray for those in authority, pray for peace so that the gospel could go forth. So one thing he would say for sure is you can pray for system change. But the idea of, the, like, we have in our society where each of us has the ability to advocate for system change was not something available to Paul. So I don't know that he says anything that would give us a clue to how we should do it. I think it's what I do think Paul would say that I think would be really convicting if a lot of Americans would listen to it, is that the ends do not justify the means, particularly if you're trying to change something like the laws of South Dakota or the United States that's eventually going to burn. And so, is it worth doing something Christ would not approve of in the effort to change the laws of South Dakota or the United States? I think Paul would say no. The gospel and the advancement of the gospel is infinitely more important than what the laws of a secular society are. So do not do anything that would compromise your ability to be a witness for the gospel in the course of your job or politics or anything else that's really a worldly endeavor. Questions, comments, concerns about that? Yeah.
Maybe not about that, but I got a question. Is Paul saying that marriage isn't about self-fulfillment, but it's about sacrifice and service?
I think he absolutely would say that. You know, I think if you flip over to Ephesians, he's all about marriage is about mutual submission. And there may be some different ways that submission plays out for males and females, but ultimately it's about both partners in the marriage being willing to sacrifice their own interests and desires for the benefit of the other. Just like everything in the Christian life is ultimately really about service. Anything we're given is given to us to serve others for their benefit, and marriage is no exception, and he wants each spouse to think about that. So I don't think that's what he's thinking about in terms of the afflictions and troubles. I think that's a slightly different thing, but absolutely part of what should go into the calculus of whether you want to get married is, am I willing to submit myself to this other person who is going to be flawed just like I'm flawed? Either of those things open up can of worms anyone else wanted to follow up on? Anyone have any questions about the chapter they wanted to investigate further? So sort of to sum up, kind of the outline, I think, of what's going on this chapter is in response to an inquiry from Corinthians who are arguing that celibacy represents a higher spiritual status, and so believers should not marry and should even separate from believing spouses. I think that's the background in Corinth. Paul is saying, well, some of that is off track. Believers who are married to believing spouses should continue their marriage with normal, consensual sex. Believers married to unbelievers should continue if the unbelieving spouse is willing to stay. If the unbelieving spouse does not want to continue the marriage, peacefully let the unbeliever go their way. My opinion, your mileage may vary. The believer is no longer bound to the unbeliever in that situation. Widowers, widows may righteously choose to remarry another believer, especially if they're struggling with celibacy, or they may choose to remain single. Paul even says in Timothy, he advises young women, that might be the best option for you. Young single people may righteously choose to marry or remain single. That's countercultural in his day, just as it is in ours. But what really matters is keeping God's commands, so everybody, regardless of your situation, needs to prioritize obeying Christ. Right? And I think one way you can mitigate the danger that Paul is concerned about with marriage is to make sure you marry someone with the same spiritual priorities.
I just had a quick question.
Yep.
To the unbeliever. Now, with, I don't think he dives into it, but then in that situation, would they be able to marry?
Yeah, so that is the $64 question, and there are a lot of people, including the Roman Catholic Church, that generally holds a line on it, that think, yes, they're free to remarry. And I was persuaded that I thought that was a good reading of the passage. There are others that say, nah, I don't think Paul is even thinking about remarriage there. And so there are different opinions out there about that. But I think the concept of being not bound by the marriage implies free to remarry. You then have to deal with the verse, a woman's bound to her husband as long as he lives. And so that would be the argument for the other view. But I think when Paul says that, he's thinking you have in mind what he just said that you referenced. But yeah, we talked about this last week. There's actually a technical name for the view that she's not free. I mean, that she is free to remarry. It's called the Pauline privilege. Good question. Yep.
So how do we justify the call here of being single compared to many other places in Scripture that say be fruitful and multiply?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I have a friend who was a very serious Presbyterian. Now he's a very serious Catholic. And so he believes birth control is wrong in any form, right? And so we've had discussions about this. I think you could, one of the implications of what Paul says is that be fruitful and multiply, mission accomplished. I mean, I don't think he's saying we need to minimize the number of kids we have, but he sure doesn't seem to put, like, he had lots of opportunities in this chapter to say, if we're going to fulfill what God said in Genesis, you better get married and have as many kids as you can. And he does not say anything like that, and think, I would argue, everything he says is logically against that. And so my response is, we've been fruitful, we have multiplied. That doesn't need to be something that's a command. Based on 1 Corinthians 7, you need to think about where Christ has called you and what your life situation is. I think you're free to make any choice you want to make on birth control. I'm not talking about that. Right. And Paul didn't choose that lifestyle either. So I think this is a passage where if that were still a concern, we would hear it in this chapter, and we didn't. But one of the most difficult areas of studying the New Testament is trying to figure out, so what in the Old Testament still applies today, and what's been changed by the New Testament? Because you got Jesus saying, you know, the law is not going to pass away until I've fulfilled it. And then you've got Peter being told, don't call things unclean that I've said are now clean, even though they haven't been through all the ceremony that you were, and the believers get together in Acts 15 and say, we aren't going to make Gentiles comply with the Jewish code. So it's really hard to sort through all that. Yeah, I would argue one of the messages Jesus has in the Gospels is your spiritual family is actually more important than your biological family. And he considers his followers to be his family. And being part of that family is actually more important than your family of origin. And, you know, John and Paul talk about the people they worked with as their kids. And so John will say, you know, nothing makes me happier than to hear my children are walking in the faith. He means his spiritual children. So I'm comfortable with that, that now our spiritual family is actually more important than our biological family. It doesn't mean biological family is bad. I think Paul thinks that's good. And he talks in 1 Timothy about how taking care of them is part of your faith. But that's no longer the priority, my opinion. You know, to really answer these questions, you got to put together multiple passages, and so certainly Christians can disagree. Other questions, comments, concerns? That was a challenging one. All right, let's stop. Thanks.